This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, we learn how anthropology is being used to solve cold cases in northeastern Wisconsin. But first, the investigation into Wisconsin's 2020 presidential election by former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman is ongoing with a new contract issued by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. But Democrats and now some Republicans are raising new questions about the validity of the effort after a Dane County judge ordered the release of hundreds of pages of public records from this investigation, showing an apparent lack of progress, according to the judge. We're learning more about what these documents reveal about the investigation and where Gabelman's efforts might go from here. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Interested in knowing how you feel about the Gabelman investigation, whether or not you want to see it continue. Do you think the 2020 election in Wisconsin needs more scrutiny? Or do you think Voss and Republicans need to move on? 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page anytime. Our guest is Jack Kelly, Wisconsin politics reporter for the Cap Times. Jack, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
I'm glad you can suss it out for us. Michael Gabelman filed his report and gave his recommendations to the Assembly Committee last week, but it appears to be another interim report. So what is left for him to do now with this new contract?
So that's a great question. The language here has been a little confusing. Speaker Robin Voss had been referring to this as his final report for weeks before it came out. And then, of course, at that hearing before the Committee on Campaigns and Elections, he was referring to it as his second interim report. What work is still to be done from here? It's a little unclear. The new contract itself kind of lays this out for us. It says that now that he has filed this report, that he should focus on, it says right in the contract, quote, will concentrate its efforts to obtain the necessary documents and testimony to complete its investigation. So basically from here, it seems as if the speaker wants the Office of Special Counsel, which of course is run by Michael Gabelman, to go forward and kind of settle some of these lawsuits about, subpoenas. He has asked to put the mayors of Madison and Green Bay in jail. It seems from here, the speaker is hoping that the Office of Special Counsel will continue to try to flesh out some of this ongoing litigation to determine the authority of the legislature going forward in case they ever wanted to pursue another investigation like this.
Jack, how far back does this investigation now go?
Well, it's been going on for quite some time. It started in earnest last summer. And this is the second contract extension that we have seen for Gabelman. Initially, the review was scheduled to end October 31st and then December 31st. And then Gabelman actually operated kind of in contractual limbo for a couple of months. And then on Tuesday, we finally saw an updated contract. So it goes all the way back and really commenced in earnest when Speaker Voss announced it at the state party convention last summer. Of course, this came shortly after a meeting that Speaker Voss had with former President Donald Trump. This has been going on for months, and it has shifted in scope at times. And last week we finally kind of got a look behind the scenes with this 136-page second interim report, as they're calling it.
Well, is that more behind the scenes than the 761 pages that was released as a result of one of the, I think, three open records cases against the special counsel right now?
Yeah, so that's interesting. There are three cases ongoing. All three of them were brought by a liberal watchdog group called American Oversight, which is headquartered in D.C., but they sue government agencies all around the country for public records. So the records released by the judge this week, the judge said this. He said during a hearing that it seems that this was much ado about nothing. There was a lot. They fought this for months. They fought the release of these documents for months, and the documents showed very little as it related to the investigation itself. The interim report made similar. You can have similar takeaways from the interim report. Gabelman makes a lot of claims. Obviously, he made his recommendations. There is not a ton of information to back up some of the things that he says. I'd have to look at the report again, but I'm fairly certain he goes through the whole 136-page report and doesn't even include footnotes to kind of support some of the claims that he's making. So both the documents released on Tuesday by a judge and the interim report, as the judge said, it shows that you know, the Office of Special Counsel and Gableman, they have not pursued a ton in their review, even though it's been going on for several months now.
Jack Kelly's our guest, Wisconsin politics reporter for the Cap Times. Interested in what you think about this ongoing special counsel investigation into the 2020 presidential election at 1-800-642-1234. The 761 pages released earlier this week as a result of a decision from a Dane County Circuit judge. What do they reveal? What do they include? What's in this tome?
Yeah, so this is a great question. I think any journalist loves the opportunity to page through, you know, 700 plus pages of documents. Some of them were repeats. There were a handful of times where I found myself at page 400 in the PDF and was kind of confused because I had already read something. Some things that they show, Eric Cardall, who is a conservative attorney, works with a law firm based in Minneapolis. Works with another organization called the Thomas More Society, which I believe is subletting office space from the special counsel at their office in Brookfield, seems to have been heavily involved in the review. You know, he makes all sorts of connections for Michael Gableman. At one point, I'm fairly certain he started the process of reaching out to kind of a PR management consulting company in Chicago on behalf of the Office of Special Counsel. And it's important to keep in mind here that Eric Cardall is not one of the publicly announced members of the review staff. You know, Gableman told us this a couple of hearings ago about who was all on his staff, and Cardall was not one of them.
But he has, and Jack, you're saying that it seems as though he may have rented some space with the special counsel's office?
Yeah, so he works with this group called the Thomas More Society. And, you know, they're a conservative group and they're involved in a lot of election related, you know, projects and lawsuits. And
he did. Didn't he sue to try to not decertify, but stop the certification of the presidential election? Is that Eric Cardall?
Yes. He was representing the Wisconsin Voters Alliance, which is the president, Ron Hoyer of the Wisconsin Voters Alliance. Hoyer is actually a paid member of Gableman's review staff. So his emails reviewed that this relationship between the two of them seems to be much closer than previously known. Now, obviously, we knew they were working together. Cardall testified immediately after Gableman last week before the Assembly Committee. Cardall conducted a series of interviews with nursing home residents that Gableman showed during his testimony. So we knew it was there, but it showed that he seemed to be coordinating a lot on behalf of the Office of Special Counsel. So that was interesting. Another thing, you know, we see an email and they're talking about office supplies and how to organize documents. And at this point, they you know, in theory, were weeks or months into the review. So the documents were really interesting. It was not, you know, a substantial look that they had found a lot of wrongdoing in the Wisconsin election, but it was an interesting look into the inner workings of the Office of Special Counsel and just how they pursued this review over the last several months.
Worth reiterating the Dane County Circuit Judge Frank Remington's statement from the bench when he ordered the release of these 761 pages earlier this week, and that is he challenged the public to go through these and find what he said would be an argument that there has been an investigation, much less the conclusions that have been made by the Office of Special Counsel. Are there more documents to be obtained?
Potentially. You know, obviously their Wisconsin public records law is fairly open and it is fairly robust, but there are some interesting exceptions, right? Lawmakers, legislators, members of the legislature do not have to preserve documents unless they are requested by someone. So, you know, unless a member of the public or a journalist requests records, lawmakers aren't allowed to delete them. They don't have to preserve them. So there is some discussion about whether documents related to the review were deleted after a public records request came in. Just today, some new developments happened in another one of the open records lawsuits where an attorney for American Oversight said that an attorney for Speaker Rob Voss had access to records that had been deleted, and it was going to be up to a different Dane County judge to determine if they were to be released. So there's potentially more documents to come. What those documents will tell us, we'd have to wait and see until we actually have access to them.
Jack Kelly, Wisconsin politics reporter for the Capital Times. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 if you've got a question about the Wisconsin legislators' special counsel investigation in the 2020 presidential election. This is the place to have it. And Jack, I'm some of the documents that were released earlier this week from the open records request include subpoenas, some which were never issued, some that have not been signed. And I understand these subpoenas have to be signed by the Speaker of the Legislature, Robin Voss, as well as another. What's your takeaway from these subpoenas that were part of this document release?
So subpoenas have to be signed by both Speaker Voss as well as the Assembly Chief Clerk. The subpoenas are kind of all over the map. So Representative Mark Spreitzer, who's a Democrat from Beloit, who is a Democratic member of the Assembly Committee on Campaigns and Elections, posted 86, I believe, subpoenas to his legislative website yesterday. An aide to Spreitzer told me that these subpoenas came from the first batch of subpoenas that Gableman issued, which were back in early October, as well as some of the ones that he issued in December. They show how wide-ranging the review has been. Obviously, you know, two of the big elements that we know now that Gableman's team has been focused on are how was voting handled at nursing homes during the pandemic. Obviously, the Racine County Sheriff did a report about this. Gableman pursued it. And also, how was grant funding from a private organization called the Center for Tech and Civic Life, which is a nonprofit, used by municipalities as a part of election administration. So the subpoenas, which are issued to a wide range of people, both in and out of Wisconsin, show the wide-ranging nature of the review and shows, you know, the somewhat haphazard nature of the review. You know, experts have told me that this seems to have been a haphazard review. You know, you talk to election administration experts, someone like Barry Burden at UW-Madison or Trey Grayson, who's the Republican former Secretary of State of Kentucky, you know, the former chief election official in Kentucky. If you're going to do a review of an election, they can be beneficial. They can be useful. You should do it. It's an exercise in good government. But they always say there should be very clear parameters set out. What are you trying to determine? How long do you have? How are you doing that? And the subpoenas show that, you know, these things seem to have really come and gone as different developments came out. His team started to pursue different leads. So the subpoenas were really interesting. Also, that list from Spreitzer is not comprehensive. He has 86 of them. The speaker said recently in a radio interview that he has issued more than 100 of them. I recently obtained a subpoena that was issued in February. So, you know, as recently as last month, they were still issuing subpoenas. So it's interesting. It shows the wide-ranging nature of it. But it's hard to glean exactly what they have learned from these subpoenas.
We're talking with Cap Times reporter Jack Kelly about the latest in the Michael Gableman investigation of the 2020 presidential election in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you. We got calls around the bend at 1-800-642-1234. Get your reaction, what you think about Michael Gableman, whether or not you trust him, and what will come of his special counsel investigation. You can always comment on our Ideas Network Facebook page, and our conversation continues next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and we're picking up our talk with Jack Kelly, Wisconsin politics reporter from the Capital Times, with us to take us through a new set of documents, hundreds made public from former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman's investigation into Wisconsin's 2020 presidential election. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234. And Jack, since you were talking about Eric Cardall and the work that they have, this private attorney from Minnesota has done, at least apparently in conjunction with the Wisconsin special counsel investigation. And I saw Michael Gableman was on Tucker Carlson with Fox News earlier this week. Where is the argument of impartiality into this investigation? Is there one?
You know, this is interesting. Democratic members of the Assembly Committee that is purportedly overseeing this investigation, you know, asked Michael Gableman during last week's hearing, why should the people of Wisconsin trust you? And he actually became borderline emotional in responding to it. You know, he gave a long kind of talk about how he's committed himself to public service. He was a circuit court judge, of course, was on the Supreme Court. But he did admit and kind of danced around the answer to why should people trust him. But he did come out and say that he voted for Donald Trump. Obviously, he's made previous statements, unfounded statements about votes being stolen by the Elections Commission, I believe is what he said. So, I mean, It's from the jump, there have been questions about the impartiality, right? This was a review that received no bipartisan support. It was supported only by Assembly Republicans, and largely has continued to be supported only, or pretty much has only been supported by Republicans throughout the duration, though some Republicans now are even being skeptical of it. So, you know, that was a question that they asked, and Michael Gableman did not have a great answer to it last week during the committee.
That's Jack Kelly from the Cap Times. Now we go to you, and we'll start with Randy in Madison. Randy, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Good afternoon. I am particularly disturbed. I've done quite a few, been a poll worker on quite a few elections, and the election officials I've dealt with, and I'm speaking here in Madison, are some of the most competent and people of the highest integrity I've ever known, in very marked contrast to these investigators. Like I said, I'm very disturbed that the point of the investigation seems to be to smear these people because they work in cities like Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay, maybe La Crosse, where the votes will tend to go for the Democrats.
Randy, I appreciate the perspective, and it's something I've heard before, and I've seen the clerks actually put out their own ad in Wisconsin about the work that they do, and maybe little was known about it. But, you know, what are some of the responses from clerks across the state into this investigation?
Yeah, I mean, clerks... are often underspoken people. You know, they're diligent workers. They serve their local communities. So, you know, we hear less from the clerk, but let's take the city of Madison, for example. We don't hear from the clerk directly, but we hear a lot from the mayor of Madison, Satya Rhodes Conway, who is a fierce critic of this review. Obviously, you know, Michael Gableman has asked a Waukesha County judge to put her in jail for shrugging his subpoena. She's been... You know, I think they've used the term fraudit. They have, you know, they've been very critical. You almost run out of adjectives that they've used talking about the review. It's a little bit hard to say what clerks think, but I will say that, you know, we've seen evidence. Barry Burden from UW-Madison did a survey of municipal clerks, because obviously municipal clerks are the lifeblood of Wisconsin elections. Wisconsin has a very decentralized election system. And he found a high burnout rate among election clerks. I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but he found a high burnout rate. So the stress of the 2020 election and its aftermath is definitely taking a toll on municipal clerks around the state.
Let's go to Mary in Wauwatosa. Mary, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Hi. I agree with the previous caller. I also want to say that I'm outraged that our taxpayer money has gone to fund this flim-flam con man's job, which now I hear wasn't very well done anyway. And the fact that he's got more money coming to him to do this is ridiculous. I think everybody should be embarrassed who has given him approval to do this. And frankly, I'm embarrassed that this man was a Wisconsin Supreme Court justice.
Mary, thank you for the call. And I feel like maybe Speaker Voss's attempt to, at some degree, you know, placate this investigation, but at other times, you know, make clear that there's no decertification that is available for the 2020 election under the law as we know it. And that seems to be pretty uniform of a statement. So what about, you know, some of the Republicans and how they have had to how they've had to take a side on this investigation?
Yeah, one thing I should mention that Mary pointed out. So the contract extension between Voss and Gableman goes to the end of April. It does not actually include an increase in Gableman's budget. He's still operating under that initial $676,000.
Okay.
The one exception to that being that, you know, Speaker Voss did say that the assembly will cover, you know, legal costs for some of this ongoing litigation. So in theory, there could be more expense to taxpayers there, but the actual budget has not been increased. In terms of Republicans having to navigate this, you know, it has definitely been interesting to watch. We have seen, you know, several, I might be up to 10 now, I would have to double check, you know, county Republican parties who want to see Speaker Voss replaced. We have seen some members of the Senate, someone like Kathy Bernier, who is retiring, who's been a big skeptic and critic of the review.
She's a former clerk herself, right?
Right, right. A former municipal clerk herself, former, you know, election official for, and I think,
it's interesting,
years.
Jack, because she is the outgoing chair of the Senate Elections Committee. But then in the Assembly Elections Committee, you have Janelle Branchon, who was even recently made mention of or called into question the integrity of Wisconsin's elections.
Yeah, I mean, Representative Branchon was in attendance at an, you know, an air quotes election integrity rally at the Wisconsin Capitol a few weeks ago. She was appearing alongside State Rep Timothy Rampton, who is, you know, also now a GOP gubernatorial candidate. And, you know, they were pushing for kind of peddling these ideas that there was some wrongdoing with Wisconsin's election in 2020.
Jack, I got to ask you, since you've been watching it all, what are you looking for next?
What am I looking for next? That's a great question. You know, I am interested in the outcome of some of this litigation. Now, this is a more technical answer than you were probably expecting, but the outcome of this litigation could really define the scope of the legislature's ability to do future investigations. You know, if a judge determines that these subpoenas that Gableman has been issuing aren't valid because they're seeking to compel testimony in private rather in front of the committee, that could, you know, change the way that a potential future investigation would, you know, play out. Obviously, you know, as a politics reporter, I'm very interested in knowing whether or not a Waukesha County judge will actually go forward and try to jail Madison Mayor Saatchi Rhodes Conway and a handful of other Wisconsin officials. So I think that's interesting. I think, you know, we waited for a long time for this second interim report because Speaker Voss had told us they wanted to legislate based off the findings of the report. Of course, the legislature is now out of session. They have passed a flurry of election related bills, most of which will be vetoed by Governor Tony Evers. So it will be interesting. I think, you know, the review is winding down, but it's really going to fall into this litigation now.
Jack Kelly, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Jack Kelly's Wisconsin politics reporter for the Cap Times with us today, checking in on the 2020 election investigation in Wisconsin by former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman and where things might go from here. There is certainly a bigger picture afoot. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, of course, there's an app for that. But when we're talking about teens, mindfulness, and mental health, how effective can an app on your smartphone actually be? We'll find out what the research says about the use of mindfulness apps by teenagers tomorrow morning on The Morning Show. Yet another exciting oceanic find out of Montana. According to the AP, a 4.5-inch fossil found in an ancient seabed in Bear Gulch, Montana, way back in 1988, sat in a drawer at the Royal Ontario Museum for years. And an astute paleontologist pointed out that this fossil that predates the dinosaurs is absolutely unique. This ancient animal unbelievably had 10 limbs. A closer look revealed evidence of an ink sac, making these remains the oldest known ancestor of the octopus at about 330 million years old. Now, we're only beginning to understand how smart these amorphous sea creatures can be, and now we're beginning to understand how old. The scientists who discovered this new pre-Jurassic species of octopus have named it Solipsipomodi bideni, after President Joe Biden, and they say his commitment to science and research. Say it again, Solipsipomodi bideni. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn and for Rob Ferret today, and coming up tonight after 6 on 1A Plus with Jen White. Turning on or tuning out the war in Ukraine. How are your friends and family coping with this latest war, and how can we get some perspective and some peace among the stories and images of wartime? That's tonight after 6 with Jen White right here on the Ideas Network. Now, Starkey Swenson was presumed dead in 1983, and Swenson's case sat unsolved for 38 years. That is until a UW Oshkosh anthropologist in his class took up Swenson's case. They spent last spring and summer digging for his remains in the woods and fields near Omro, and then a breakthrough. they found Swenson's remains. And our guest today is going to tell us more about the Swenson case and how they continue to use anthropology to help solve cold cases in northeastern Wisconsin. And we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. You listen to podcasts or watch TV shows about cold cases? Yeah, they're irresistible. Are you curious about a cold case in your community? And what do you want to know about the work it takes to find human remains and the role anthropologists can play in crime solving? 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us, ideas@wpr.org. Jordan Karsten is with us today. He's an associate professor of anthropology and the chair of the Anthropology, Global Religions, and Culture Department at UW-Oshkosh. Jordan and his students are working to solve cold cases in northeastern Wisconsin. And Jordan, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Really appreciate your time this afternoon. And then I'd start with just give us some idea of what role an anthropologist can play in cold cases.
Well, I mean, I help out with law enforcement across the state whenever they have questions about searching for a clandestine burial. If they've found bones and they don't know if they're human or animal, they'll give me a call to see if I can help. And then if they find human remains, I also will help, try to figure out who that person was. Was it a male or a female? How tall were they? How old were they when they died? Approximately how long has it been since they died? And so we have a lot of skills that we can use to help out law enforcement when they have one of these kind of suspicious death investigations. And so, yeah, I think we can bring a lot to the table.
Hey, Jordan, is this something you expected when you got into anthropology?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I think of myself mostly as an archaeologist.
Yeah.
And so my archaeological site I did my research on for my PhD is in Western Ukraine. And so some of our work in archaeology is finding things that are buried. Yeah. And so we utilize technology like ground penetrating radar, pedestrian surveys in order to find this, these objects buried in the ground. And then it's our expertise to actually excavate them and do our best to make sure that we recover everything that might be there, right? Even the smallest bone fragment, the smallest artifact. And so by taking those methods, the methods that we use in archaeology and applying them to cold cases where you're looking for clandestine burials, we can really contribute to the effort.
Sifting and winnowing with Jordan Karsten, our guest, associate professor of anthropology at UW-Oshkosh. And Jordan, you have a podcast about the work you're doing to solve cold cases. It's called Cold Case of Frozen Tundra. What got you started on this?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I mean, so Winnebago County Sheriff got a hold of me 2 Octobers ago, so October 2020. And they asked if I would be willing to help with the search for the remains of Starkey Swenson. And I didn't know anything about the case at the time. And we went out to a scene in Omro where they had some intelligence to suggest that this individual who was murdered in 1983 was actually buried. And so they wanted me to, use those skills I was just talking about in terms of doing a pedestrian survey, using some remote sensing technology in order to try to figure out if there's something buried in the area. And we went out there and it was a big project. I mean, a big, huge property to really search it kind of comprehensively. And so I got into the case just kind of figuring out what happened. And as I did, I realized that the story of Starkey Swenson's murder was a really interesting story. And it also gave me the idea, because podcasts, true crime podcasts, are so popular that by putting one together, you never know for a cold case if somebody hears that you're doing it or chooses to listen, it might just trigger a memory that, that might actually help break open a cold case. And those people might be, they might have that kind of recollection of something that happened in the past, call me, call the investigators, and we might be onto something totally new. And so I figured not only would it be interesting, and not only does Starkey Swenson deserve to have his story told and not forgotten, but it does play this kind of additional role of potentially encouraging people to come forward with information to help break open a cold case. And so that gave me the idea to put a true crime podcast together surrounding the Starkey Swenson disappearance.
And you're getting ready for your next one, and we'll get to that first. But one of the questions I had for you, Jordan, was specifically, you know, how do you do this without, you're dealing with tragedy, and how do you deal with this while protecting those who were traumatized by this tragedy? So when you were dealing with Starkey Swenson and looking for his remains, what was your relationship with the Swenson family?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, before I even got started in the first podcast and looking at Starkey Swenson's case, I talked to law enforcement to say, hey, is this something that would be useful? Is this something that's not going to be harmful to the family and friends of somebody like Starkey Swenson? And they decided that it was a good idea. And as we put it together, I actually became friends with some of Starkey Swenson's family members. And as we actually carried out our search in the Omro area, his family members came out to visit our excavation and our search. And so in terms of my relationship with them, I ended up developing a close relationship with them. And, you know, I think that generally speaking, they appreciated the fact that somebody wanted to take a lot of time to tell the story so it's not forgotten, to put the effort in, to try to make moves on a case that was almost four decades old. And so honestly, the relationships I made with them are relationships I'll keep for the rest of my life.
So this brings us to your next investigation. Jordan Karsten, this is the story of the disappearance of Lori Jean Deppis, who disappeared in 1992.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting case. And for most people in Wisconsin, it is one that people are familiar with. What happened after the Starkey Swenson case is we had a pretty big listenership. Like, we had a lot of people who were tuning into our podcast from the Fox Valley, Green Bay area, and from across Wisconsin. And so I thought to myself, okay, could we, you know, focus this in with our listeners on another case? And if we do, we still stand the chance of, you know, triggering these old memories and getting someone to come forward with new information. And so we decided to look for another case that we could do, and we found the case of Lori Deppis, who actually went missing from the Fox River Mall back in the early 1990s. And so I talked to the investigators who were in charge of the case. They got in touch with the family. We got everybody on board. You know, I wasn't going to do it if the investigators and the family didn't think that this was a good idea. And everybody thought that it was a good idea, especially heading into the 30th anniversary of her disappearance. And so we're in the process of researching and putting together our episodes outlining the cold case and the disappearance of Lori Deppis.
Our guest, Jordan Karsten, Associate Professor of Anthropology at UW-Oshkosh. Your calls at 1-800-642-1234. We're Jake and Appleton standing by. Good afternoon, Jake. Jake, are you there? Looks like we're going to miss out on Jake. So let's take a moment here. But to reiterate, if you've got a question for Jordan, 1-800-642-1234. And what might you know about the disappearance of Lori Deppis back in 1992 from the Fox River Vault Mall? We'll continue the conversation with our guest, Jordan Karsten, Associate Professor of Anthropology and the Chair of the Anthropology, Global Religions, and Culture Department at the UW-Oshkosh as we continue on these cold cases here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and we're continuing our talk about how anthropology can be used to solve cold cases here in Wisconsin. Jordan Karsten, Chair of the Anthropology Department at UW-Oshkosh, stays with us, and now Delaney Rickles joins us. Delaney is an anthropology student at UW-Oshkosh. She worked with Jordan in the search for Starkey Swenson's remains. Delaney, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I really appreciate your time this afternoon. And just so, tell us a little bit about your experience on the search for Starkey Swenson's remains and what that work was like for you as an anthropology student at UW-Oshkosh.
Well, I worked on it back in October of 2020 as well. And for me there, I was mainly metal detecting and trying to see if there was anything in the woods that we ended up excavating, and got a lot of scratches from all of the trees and bushes that we had to climb through.
Yeah. So
Delaney got the bad jobs, unfortunately. she's a real trooper.
Which is why we invited her here this afternoon. So Delaney, tell us a little bit about what this field work looks like. You know, when you go out there to do this, as you mentioned, you get all the scratches and scrapes. What are some of the tools you need? What's the site like? Give us the lay of the land.
Oh man, the lay of the land. Well, when we first went, it was full of trees and bushes and like the really awful ones that have little thorns. And so those were awful. Once we got there, though, in the summer with the whole class, we were lucky enough to have all of the main landscape kind of plowed down so we'd be able to dig. But other than that, I mean, the main tools we used were like shovels, trowels, and buckets.
And what would you think, what would you say was the most difficult part or period of this investigation into the remains of Starkey Swenson, Delaney?
Oh, the hardest part probably was like not knowing if we were going to find him or not, because a lot of us were putting so much like time and effort into helping this family. And when you like sit down and think about it, you get really worried that you're not going to be able to solve it for them in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. So this Starkey Swenson case, it's from the early 80s. But this was a case, as I understand, Jordan Karsten, where the person had committed to the murder, but we just did not have the Starkey's remains. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the story itself is really interesting. And of course, I encourage people who are interested to listen to the podcast.
Yeah.
But it's what happened was in the early 90s, a man named John Andrews was convicted of Starkey's murder. He actually pled an Alford plea, which allowed him to maintain his innocence, and he ended up sentenced to homicide by negligent use of a motor vehicle. And so, I mean, very technically speaking, the case was over and solved. The issue was that Starkey Swenson himself had never been found. Mm-hmm.
So the chance to heal and to find some closure for the Starkey Swenson family. But now you're looking into this cold case of missing woman, Lori Depess. And so let's start with what we know about Lori Depess at this point, Jordan, and how this investigation moves forward for you.
Yeah, I mean, the case itself is it's another one that grabs your attention. I mean, Lori was this young woman working at the Fox River Mall in the 1990s. When malls were basically like downtowns, and she left one evening after closing her store, shows up at her boyfriend's house, and they hear her drive in because she had a loud muffler, but she never comes to the door. And when they go downstairs, a group that was there kind of gathered for a social evening, they see that her car is locked, that a soda cup sitting on the roof of her car, and there's no sign of Lori Depess. And so, and that's basically where, in a lot of ways, the case leaves off. I mean, it's gone down a lot of different kind of investigative paths, including serial killers. And so I think telling the story as accurately as possible, not going into things that are kind of fantastical. I mean, just the facts and trying to stick to it and laying it out there for people where it might encourage people to come forward to give us some information to help with this case. That's the goal.
Delaney Rinkle, as an anthropology student, were you expecting to be involved in solving crimes?
Oh, no. Not even a little bit.
But once you were, I mean, did that change the way you saw what your field of study could be and could do?
Oh, definitely. It was one of those things that I tried in, like, the summer of 2020 with Jordan, but I didn't realize what you could use anthropology for as much. And then when we started doing that, it was like, oh, okay, kind of dig this. I could do this. And he just keeps finding new cases that I volunteer to.
So yes, will you be involved in the search for Lori Depess?
Oh my gosh, I have to be. I would be upset.
Well, Delaney's, as she said, she digs it, but she's actually a very good digger. And so she's... So as long as I can keep her around, I will, because she's great at excavating and a nice, good, careful excavator, even though I tend to give her some of the hardest jobs.
Well, yeah, you'd mentioned this, that you're looking for everything. And when you're looking for everything from something that can be 30 plus years old, it could be as much as dust at this point. So Delaney, as an anthropology student, how do you discriminate some dust that doesn't matter from some dust that just might?
Oh, I have to ask so many questions.
Yeah.
From Jordan specifically, like when we were digging for in Almro, there was all of these rocks that were just so close to bone colored that pretty much every single one, I was like, I know this is a rock,
but
I need to verify if this is a rock because it's just a little weird, the color, the shape.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're going through every piece to try to identify whether or not it's relevant to your investigation. That's every piece out in the middle of thorns and bushes and shrubs and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's not to mention that Wisconsin is full of these glacial rocks. And so while we would dig, you know, we would sift through the earth and we would come up with these rocks.
Oh.
And that throws people for a little bit of a loop. And, you know, we give them in-class training for human osteology, the study of the human skeleton. But when you're in the field, I mean, the pressure is on,
right?
Because you don't want to misidentify something.
Hmm. So you set up the disappearance of Lori Deppis coming home from the Fox River Mall, or going to her boyfriend's apartment in the Fox River Mall, but never evidently going inside as far as we know. So where does that leave an anthropologist to begin looking 30 years later?
Well, I think the issue comes down to, are there credible leads in terms of where somebody potentially disposed of her? And it's not a pleasant thing to think of, but if there are credible leads, then we can help in terms of making that search happen. And it is relying on things like pedestrian survey. It is relying on students who can recognize human skeletal elements. It is relying on technology like ground penetrating radar in order to try to comprehensively search for places that at least are potentially of interest.
By the way, we've got a link to the podcast up at WPR.org/Central Time where you can find it anytime. And part of this conversation, Jordan and Delaney, is to ask our audience whether or not they have any knowledge of or might have any information pertaining to the disappearance of Lori Deppis. It's a story that got a lot of attention 30 years ago, but this is 30 years later. What can you expect to find?
Well, I mean, honestly, we've had, since we announced that we were going to undertake this kind of research and put out a podcast focused on her case and her story, we've had a lot of people come forward, and they've reached out to me, they've reached out to law enforcement. And so, you know, that is the goal. We don't know what we're going to find. I mean, the thing is, you never know if you've got some kind of connection to this case, or you have some information that you might even think is trivial, it might not be. I mean, on some of these cold cases, the smallest piece of information that somebody might think doesn't matter, it might be the difference between, you know, having a successful search and not. And so, you know, I urge people who think they have any kind of, you know, information that might be relevant to come forward.
Delaney Rickel is a UW Oshkosh college student. As you look at anthropology and what it teaches you, where do you see yourself going? Where would you like to go from your education?
That's like the age-old question. Mm-hmm. In a perfect world, I would love to go to graduate school and get a degree in biological anthropology, similar to what Jordan did. Mm-hmm. And then if I mean, really lucky, it'd be cool to do like forensic anthropology as a job. That would be like...
Yeah.
Top tier.
Well, how many forensic anthropologists are actually out there? Yeah.
There's a reasonable number of people who work in the field. Many people are professors, but there are people who work for, you know, medical legal institutions, medical examiner's offices, you know, for coroners, this kind of thing, the defense department. So they are there, but yeah, it does require some advanced education.
Absolutely. But as we look towards at what you're going to do next, Jordan Karsten, is there a timeline for this podcast? Can you possibly give us some idea of what to expect, where we start a few episodes and see where it goes, or, what are we looking at here?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so we are, number one, processing some of the information that's coming into us from people across Wisconsin and actually across the United States. And we're also talking to folks, and we're putting these episodes together, and they will be out this spring. We'll have episodes starting to be released before the summer, guaranteed.
Wow. All right. And we've got a link up again at WPR.org/Central Time. And you said you've already got leads that you are looking at. Are you doing any digging or looking towards any sites to dig as the our frozen tundra begins to thaw?
Yeah, not quite yet. I mean, we have some ideas that we have already based on some information. So I guess the best thing I can say is stay tuned, because I think I sincerely hope that we have some credible leads to follow.
And does Delaney join you on the podcast? Will we hear her voice at any time?
It's probably time for her to, don't you think, Delaney?
She's got some practice now.
Yeah, right? Maybe. We'll think about it.
Well, Jordan, I want to thank you for sharing your podcast and your work with us this afternoon. Delaney, I want to thank you both for joining us and looking forward to hearing what you have come this spring.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
You bet. That's Jordan Karsten, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Anthropology, Global Religions and Culture at UW-Oshkosh, and also Delaney Rickle, Anthropology student at UW-Oshkosh. Jordan and Delaney joined us to talk about using anthropology to solve cold cases in northeastern Wisconsin. And a reminder, a link to their podcast is available at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, by the way, tomorrow's Friday, that makes it Food Friday, and that means beautiful, tasty, dreamy, yeasty carbohydrates. Oh yeah, it's Food Friday, and we're going to be baking with the authors of Artisan Bread in 5 minutes a day. 5 minutes a day for that? Well, got to find out. That's tomorrow. Also tomorrow, what to do with the artesian wells in Bayfield County. That's where a Duluth-based company is suing for the right to bottle and sell the underground water collected on the land that they own in Bayfield County. Whose water is it? We'll find out. Central Time tomorrow. Join us from 3 to 6 here on the Ideas Network. Also, late word in, just in, Representative Mark Pocan will also join the show tomorrow afternoon to talk about a new congressional spending bill. That's here on Central Time.